everyone. I will call the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91 to order. Tonight we have a possible work session, which will be in the form of an information and discussion session on Senate Bill 8844, specifically the Dash 1 amendments. For those of you who are kind of new to the process, this happens very often where we have a bill and we have a bunch of stuff that needs to be done, and we've made an amendment to incorporate the OLCC recommendations into this new bill. So don't pay any attention to the underlying bill. It's the Dash 1 amendment we are talking about. Specifically, we are getting OLCC's feedback and comments and elaboration on based on our discussion last week. And then Senator Przanski has done a heroic job of going through the bill and identifying some particular items that need tweaking. So that's what we will focus on tonight. We do not expect a vote on this bill tonight, but we expect to make our way forward so we can reach a conclusion and hopefully schedule a vote in the very near future. So with that, Adam, do you want to introduce this for us?
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 8444, the committee is being asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments replace the measure. They clarify the powers and duties of the OLCC related to marijuana regulation. It prohibits the OLCC from licensing marijuana growers, processors, wholesalers, or retailers within 1,000 feet of a public or private school for which attendance is compulsory. However, it confirms the validity of the license if the public or private school for which attendance is compulsory is established within 1,000 feet of the licensee, provides peace officer authority to authorize OLCC employees, requires the OLCC to adopt rules establishing a testing laboratory license, standards for marijuana testing, and test result reporting, requires the OLCC to adopt rules defining classification of marijuana processors. It allows the OLCC to require segregation of activities at premises holding multiple licenses, requires the license holder to hold and maintain liability insurance and bond, allows the OLCC to require marijuana retailers to use age verification scanner equipment. It allows the OLCC to impose civil penalties that do not exceed $5,000 on a licensee for each day rule violations occur. It establishes the Marijuana Enforcement Fund as accredited fund for the civil penalty. It clarifies authority for other state agencies related to marijuana. It requires the State Board of Pharmacy to establish rules containing instructions for disposal of marijuana left behind at retail drug outlets. It requires the OLCC to submit reports on the influence of marijuana on a person's ability to drive to the interim committees of the Legislative Assembly on or before January 1, 2017. It defines terms. It also declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay, we are going to start tonight with a panel with the OLCC, who will talk about their recent changes in the agency and introduce their listening tour paper and some other items. And Adam, are they going to discuss these items, or will that be the next panel?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, at the dais and also on OLIS, there are OLCC furnished a report that discusses seven items, a report on the OLCC listening sessions, which Will Hegman will discuss, age verification and equipment questions, which Jesse Sweet will discuss, minors' access to licensed premises, also discussed by Jesse Sweet, background checks, also Jesse Sweet will discuss that. Nathan Ricks will handle the edible marijuana products discussion, and we have a panel from DOJ to discuss both peace officer authority as well as definitions for Measure 91 that I believe Jesse Sweet will also be joining us for.
Terrific. So we will start with our first OLCC panel, Nathan Ricks, Will Hegman, and Jesse Sweet. And Mr. Marks, you're welcome to join if you would like. Okay. Welcome to
the
committee.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I am Will Hegman. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Good, Mike.
I'm the Director of Licensing at OLSCC, and I am currently the Interim Director of the Marijuana Program. First and foremost, I really want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. Let me start off by saying the work of getting the marijuana program up and running by January 4th, 2016, or the 2016 deadline to begin accepting applications continues. I've been relying heavily on the excellent staff of the marijuana program at the OLCC, who have educated me on what has been done and what still needs to be done to integrate the marijuana program into the OLCC. To that end, I was in Olympia yesterday to meet with the officials of the Washington Marijuana Program to learn more about the implementation of their program and the lessons they learned from an operational standpoint. In the weeks and months to come, my plan is to focus my efforts in the following areas. First and foremost, I want to assure this committee and the legislature in general that we'll provide any and all information that you all need to make great policy decisions. Secondly, engage the building of our marijuana recommended budget and to gain discussions on how we will integrate the marijuana program into the current organization to maximize efficiencies to allow us to provide excellent customer service to our future licensees. Third, name the Rules Advisory Committee that will begin writing and recommending rules to support the implementation of Measure 91. And finally, hiring staff and working with my team and naming a vendor for the seed-to-sale system to support the overall program. So tonight, as you've already alluded to, we are poised to present the information you requested last week. Sorry? Perfect. I have asked Jesse Sweet from our OLCC to present the information on our age verification equipment, information on minors' access to licensed premises, and background checks. Nathan Ricks will present the information you requested on edible marijuana products. And last but not least, we will conclude with Shannon O'Fallon and Herb Lovejoy of the DOJ, and again Jesse Sweet, on the definitions of for Measure 91 and Peace Officer Authority. But before I turn the microphone over, I want you to know we have submitted our final report to you detailing our findings during our listening tour. I know you've already heard a lot about the tours, but to summarize, we held 11 listening tours across the state and talked to over 3,500 Oregonians about what they'd like to see in their recreational marijuana program. Feel free to read the report at your leisure, and please feel free to call me if you should have any questions. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present to you this evening, and if you don't have any questions, Jesse will take over and talk about the age verification equipment, but I'd love to answer any questions if you might have them.
Now, I understand that you're going to have to leave after your presentation.
Co-chair and Senator Berger, that's not true.
Oh, okay.
I think there was I was going to come up by myself to begin with and then just go back to my seat. That's all.
Okay.
Madam Chair, how did you want to do questions? Did you want to wait the panel?
Given the difference in subject matter, we'll have questions now for Mr. Hegland, if anybody has any.
Yeah, it's Will?
It's Will.
Well, thank you. Your comments kind of startled me because I thought I heard you say you're here to help integrate the medical marijuana program into the OLCC. Did I misunderstand you saying
you
that?
I'm sorry, co-chairs. Senator Pergansky, I must have misinterpreted my
testimony. Just want to make sure I didn't hear that.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Right. So I am very interested now that we've heard about some stuff. Now it's coming out in the media. I'd like to get a copy of the leaked memo and any supporting documents that goes around that, because it does seem like that at least there's some perception, at least, that maybe there was some discussions about taking the medical marijuana program and somehow folding it into under OLCC. So I'd like to have those documents, please.
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Bruce Zansky will definitely get you that information. Not a problem.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes.
Other questions from the committee? All right. Let's move on then. Who wants to go next?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I'm a policy analyst with the OLCC. I will be speaking to you regarding several subjects tonight, the first of which is age verification.
Can you speak up a little bit? I'm getting signals.
Yes. I'll be speaking on several subjects tonight, the first of which is age verification equipment. The OLCC has requested broad authority to require licensees to install age verification equipment at the point of sale of retail marijuana operations. ORS So I'll be speaking first about how this works in liquor, and then I'll be addressing some privacy concerns that I believe were raised at a prior meeting, and then I'll be concluding with how this may be applied to recreational marijuana. So starting with what we do currently for liquor, ORS 471342 allows retail licensees who have sold alcohol to a minor to purchase age verification equipment in lieu of a suspension or civil penalty. Additionally, OLCC may require the use of this equipment in certain circumstances where alcohol licenses have sold repeatedly to a minor. This equipment is designed to be used at the point of sale, and the requirements for the equipment are set forth in administrative rule. There is a wide range of equipment available on the market, some of which is capable of collecting and storing personal information, some of which is simply a calculator that is integrated into a point of sale system in which the clerk manually enters the date of birth. With respect to marijuana, the OLCC is asking for discretion to require age verification equipment as a condition for retail operations. We are asking for this authority, which we would intend to clarify in rule through the public rulemaking process. I understand at prior meetings there were some concerns raised regarding privacy of information that may be captured by this equipment. Specifically, ORS 807750 requires that a private entity that swipes an individual's driver's license or ID card may not store, sell, or share personal information collected from the swipe, and I'm paraphrasing there on the statute. OLCC has taken the position that because our administrative rules do not require that the information be stored, there is no conflict with ORS 807750. In practice, some licensees may choose equipment that creates a conflict with the statute. However, this choice is not required by our rule, and OLCC staff advise that licensees do not use such equipment. In our prior request, we have requested authority to use this, to require this equipment for marijuana licenses. And we have in your materials presented two policy options for your consideration on this issue. Two as it relates to the requirement of use of the equipment, and two as it relates to satisfying the privacy concerns. So the first option would be to give OLCC discretion to require the equipment and refine those requirements in rulemaking. And the second option for your consideration is to give us authority to require that equipment only if the licensee has first sold to a minor. Regarding the privacy, the two policy options presented in the materials are to provide by law that OLCC must ensure the data protection required by ORS 807750, and the second is to require that licensees may not use any age verification equipment that conflicts with the statute I referenced. And I'd be happy to answer any questions on this issue.
I think what I'd like to do is go ahead and open it for questions on specific issues as you go through them, just to get the sense of the committee. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Jesse, thank you. I appreciate the options presented. Just to be clear, however, right now, in regard to alcohol, the requirement to use the mechanical verification is that done after the first offense of selling to a minor when that violation is found by the OLCC?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Buckley. There's essentially two ways this happens in alcohol. One is the licensee's option, where they can choose to purchase and use the equipment in lieu of a suspension or civil penalty after a sale to a minor. The second way that this is utilized in alcohol is when there have been documented compliance issues at a premises, the agency can propose restrictions on the license in order to deal with those issues. So in the first instance, it's the licensee's choice. In the second instance, it's imposed by the agency.
And to follow up, please?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So just so I understand, so one of the options you're presenting is to exactly mirror the process that's in place for violations of alcohol licenses. Is that correct, or is there some variation in that you're saying with marijuana it would be the first offense, but it might not be the first offense for alcohol? I just wanted some clarification whether it's the exact mirror or not.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Buckley. We are not proposing an exact mirror. I think the options contained in this document deviate somewhat from what we do in alcohol, in that alcohol specifically allows this option as a way to evade penalty. Maybe evade is a poor word choice. Substitute a penalty for the purchase of AVE. Where here we are saying that the two options essentially are require AVE for all points of sale, and the second option would be require AVE only after a sale to a minor is made. So that second option is similar to what we do in alcohol when there's documented compliance problems, but the first option is dissimilar. And the option of choosing AVE in lieu of suspension is dissimilar as well.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Pazansky.
Jesse, following up on Representative Buckley's questions and your testimony about AVE, I understand there's equipment that's out there on the market, and one of the things you're asking for is some type of authority to require that to be used. Do you actually, in the alcohol arena, have a list of, let's say, sanctioned or authorized AVE equipment that can be used, as compared to stuff that can't be used, or is it just anything goes currently in the alcohol area?
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Pazansky, we do not have a list of approved vendors and equipment. We do have a list of requirements for the AVE. One of the requirements is that the AVE is capable of keeping records of results. And again, that's results only, time of sale, and whether AVE was employed, and essentially pass-fail. It doesn't require that personal information be stored.
Okay, if I can follow up. So understanding the sensitivity that we've heard from people that have testified regarding this personal information, swiping, et cetera, can you walk us through if, say, it was required by the agency of one of the retail outlets, would you have someone from the agency going out to confirm it meets the standards that you've placed on them, or how's that going to work?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Pazansky. That is a detail which I believe would be spelled out in administrative rule. I can tell you what we do currently for alcohol. When somebody exercises this option, we have a follow-up visit where the inspector verifies that the equipment is present, being used, and meets our standards.
If I can maybe make a comment as compared to follow-up, it seems like if this is going to be something we would be wanting to do, it seems to me that y'all should also be including to assure that whatever equipment they're getting is going to meet the standards that we're going to be setting, and not just see if they've actually installed a piece of equipment. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
I think Representative Helm had a question.
Thank you, ma'am. Can you give us an idea of, on the alcohol side, where there's been a sale to a minor and the choice is made for electronic identification? What's the percentage of stores that have had this happen to them and have chosen that route? Do we have a rough idea? I know that's a...
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Helm, I do not have that information. I can follow up and send that in if you'd like.
Just one follow-up, please. My point here is that it seems like every store could have had at some point in time either intentional or an accidental misstep there, and they all end up getting into the same group in the end anyway. So that changes our policy distinction into a non-decision.
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Helm, I'd stated that I need to follow up to get you a precise number. I can tell you anecdotally that it's less than half have chosen to exercise this option.
Okay.
Many licensees simply choose to settle the violation, to pay their fine, rather than going to the added trouble of installing the equipment.
Okay. That's very helpful.
Representative Wilson.
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. Jesse, question for you. It seems the difference in the AVE equipment is marked between the alcohol side and the cannabis side. A question that I would have is that a Cole memo issue, the reason we're approaching it differently on the cannabis side?
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Wilson, certainly the Cole memo outlines the need to prevent distribution to minors. This is something that we, of course, take very seriously on the liquor side, but I think there is even greater concern, if I may, on the marijuana side in order to prevent access to minors. And this will be a theme, actually, on several of the issues that I present
okay,
today.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to refine that question, too, and to specifically ask you, do you think we'd be in jeopardy with the Cole memorandum if we did it as we do with alcohol, where you do it after one offense, but you don't uniformly require it?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As I'm sure you all know, we have the Cole memo, but we don't have a lot of clarification from the federal government beyond the Cole memo. So when we ask the question, would we be in jeopardy, that's a difficult question to ask, and I think it requires some speculation. The agency's position, I think at this point, could be fairly characterized as trying to be as cautious as possible and attempting to have all of the tools available to us in order to prevent the distribution to minors.
To follow up on that, if we were to require everyone to have this equipment in it, would it be any problem with the Cole memorandum if we set very specific parameters on what kind of information could be gathered? In other words, with erring in the direction of protecting privacy, not erring, I happen to like privacy, but to go in that direction, require the equipment, but set firm sideboards on the amount of information that could be collected. Would that be in any way inconsistent with the Cole memorandum?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't believe so.
Senator Pruzanski.
Madam Co-Chair, following up on that, it's my understanding that Washington State, and I'm not sure about Colorado, maybe you can give us that information, does not require that type of verification before someone enters a retail outlet. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Pruzanski, that is my understanding as well as far as the use of age verification equipment.
So not only Washington State, but also Colorado does not require it?
Correct. That's my understanding.
So we'd be the first state, if we went this way, to require it for anyone entering one of those facilities.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Maybe I missed something, because I thought, so what you're talking about is requiring this age verification for someone to come in, which is different than a liquor store.
Madam Co-Chair, that's correct. We require this in certain circumstances for our liquor licensees. One of the options before the committee today is to require this 100% across the board for all marijuana licensees.
To require it for all marijuana licensees, but also to require it as a condition of entering the establishment, as opposed to a condition of buying the product.
Madam Co-Chair, I will speak to this point of access to the premises on a little bit later.
Okay.
I would like to clarify that this equipment is designed to be used at the point of sale. So when we're talking about access to the premises, the equipment that's on the market doesn't necessarily fit cleanly at the door. It fits better at the cash register.
Okay. So that's a policy question that we're going to have to deal with, committee, at what point to check with age verification. So I guess we'll be discussing that later in your presentation.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. So, Jesse, maybe I'm jumping the rails here, but would I be checked, would my age be checked if I went into a rec store?
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Wilson, this is the issue essentially that we're deciding. If we're talking about a 100% across-the-board check, that means that every individual would be checked regardless of their age.
Hmm. Oh, okay. Thank you. I think I kind of like that.
It's been a few years since I've been carded, you know.
There is the flattery factor here.
Yeah.
Okay, other questions from the committee? Okay, let's move on, and then we will. Okay, let's move on.
Thank you. As I alluded to, many of these points are included in the next subject, which is minors' access to liquor stores and licensed premises. I understand that there were some questions at a previous meeting regarding how this works in terms of when minors can and can't be present in various establishments associated with the sale of alcohol. By rule, minors are not permitted in retail liquor stores unless accompanied by a parent or spouse. These are your local liquor stores where distilled spirits are sold. For licensees that allow on-premise consumption, such as bars and restaurants, OLCC assigns a minor posting identifying the times at which minors may be present. These postings range from minors being allowed at all times to minors never being allowed on the premise. And licensees must comply with the minor posting at all times, regardless of whether the minor is accompanied by a parent. The Cole memo requires that states prevent the distribution of marijuana to persons under 21 years of age. As we discussed previously, the OLCC is looking at every tool available to us to meet this requirement. So this is a high priority for us for alcohol. It's going to be a high priority for us for marijuana as well. We've requested the additional authority to require the identification of every patron be checked before entering a retail marijuana license, and to require at the agency's discretion that the retail licensees install age verification at the point of sale, as we just discussed. So this is a separate request from the one we just discussed. We are here requesting that every patron be carded upon entering a premises, essentially at the front door. And we're not requesting that the equipment be used at the door, but we are requesting the authority to require that the check be made at the door.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pruszynski.
I think what I'm hearing, and I think Representative Wilson and I are going, so basically under this configuration, someone walks into the store, they're going to get checked for their ID to come into the store and make sure they're 21. Then if they're going to actually buy product, then they're going to go through the AVE check. Is that what you're saying as an option?
Yes. Madam Co-Chair, Senator Pruszynski, that is essentially what I'm saying. And we're requesting the authority to exercise our discretion here. We don't know necessarily at this point if this is something that would be appropriate for 100% of licensees 100% of the time. But again, I think it's another tool that we would have to prevent access to minors.
Is it your feeling that whatever we do will have more protection from in the Cole memorandum context if we include it very specifically in statute, what we would like to see?
Madam Co-Chair, yes, I think that's a fair summary of our position. We have potentially some rulemaking authority on this issue, but that authority has not been fully explored. So we're requesting that the legislature make this very clear in statute. And for the record, for clarity, the minor posting scenario, which I described for on-premise liquor licenses, that is what is currently in Measure 91. Measure 91 allows the OLCC to assign a minor posting, and then if, for example, we would assign a minor posting that prohibited minors at all times, We have the authority to do that under current rule, but we are unclear regarding whether we have the authority to require an affirmative check at the door or affirmative use of age verification equipment.
Okay, so you would want to see that in statute.
Ravioli works. Just get in the neighborhood.
I like okay. Ravioli.
Yeah, thanks. Have you had any discussion internally about what you do if a person presents with out-of-state ID? Because the Cole Memorandum is pretty clear about not incentivizing or allowing exports of the product, and I just wondered what happens if you've got a person who presents with out-of-state ID and demonstrates they're 21, but it may indicate that they are a marijuana tourist, which, you know, that's fine. But the other issue is that they could be going home, you know, and take a souvenir. So have you discussed any of those issues?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Farioli. We have had some discussion of this issue. I know in Colorado, in Washington, for example, they have addressed this issue by allowing residents to purchase 1 ounce of marijuana and allowing out-of-state individuals to purchase a quarter ounce of marijuana. So the theory is the smaller amount helps to mitigate any out-of-state activity that may be occurring.
Okay, interesting theory. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Other questions from the committee? Okay, so that, let's see. So I guess I'd like to hear a little discussion from the committee just on how people are feeling about the checking cards at the front when people come in, requiring the equipment at the point of sale, or maybe only after the first offense. I'd like to get a sense of how people are regarding these options. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, I'm really having a hard time envisioning what that would look like if you had a door person, and I guess that's what you're talking about, having a door person and then somebody working behind the counter. So supposedly somebody is working full-time at the door, I guess. Is that what is envisioned here?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wilson. I believe that's what's envisioned by the request for the door check. And for your reference, this is, to my understanding, currently how medical marijuana dispensaries function, because you need to show your medical marijuana card even to enter the dispensary. Cards are checked at the door. So I think it's a business model that people who may be entering this field may be familiar with. You know, whether the check at the door and the check at the register creates redundancies, that's something for the committee to consider. I think it's fair to say that the agency's position is we would like to have all the tools available to us, so, you know, the more the better, in a sense.
Representative Buckland.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Well, you asked basically for some feedback, and I have concerns. Like my colleague, it's hard for me to envision what this process would be for someone like my colleague who's over 21 to be carded at the door, then to be carded again at a sale. Again, I am looking at the regulation of marijuana similar to the regulation of alcohol. There are federal laws against access to alcohol for people under the age, legal age of consumption. I'm comfortable mirroring that as much as possible, adding to it where we think it's reasonable to add to it or necessary to add to it. But the idea that we would make the experience of purchasing marijuana in Oregon a what would seem to me a very unfriendly experience of you know, almost guilty until proven innocent type of, you know, card at the door, card a second time. In the medical marijuana facilities, I think it's understood because having the medical marijuana card is what's providing you access to the medicine. It's my understanding that medical marijuana patients are not carded multiple times. They're asked to show their identity and their medical marijuana card, which seems to be a friendly enough consumer experience for the patient. They don't have to feel like they're somehow, again, guilty until proven innocent. They're basically providing the identification to then have access to the medicine they need to purchase. So you ask for feelings on that. That is how I'm looking at it right now.
And that's what I'm looking for. Are there comments, Senator Pazanski?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, I agree with Representative Buckley. It seems to me that someone coming in the door, I think that the owner of that premise could have the discretion, if they wanted, to have some type of a check and trying to keep someone coming in that's under 21. But my understanding, I understand that if someone is in violation or is not doing a good job, that you need to ensure that that's not occurring or they need to be sanctioned. And it seems to me that the point of sale, whether it should be universal for each and every person who's purchasing, that's one option that we could do, or it could be, as we've seen or what we've heard regarding how the alcohol monitoring occurs, that once there is a problem that has been identified, then there is the steps that, and this could be one of those tools that would be used at that point. I'm not real comfortable having the double check. That does seem very overbroad. And this would make it, as Representative Buckley said, very unfriendly for individuals going in to have to go through that type of experience. I also understand and believe that in the medical facilities, that it's not until you are actually going into where the product is where you are limited as to needing to have the card and going beyond that door, as compared to going into a lobby area. So I think there's some distinction there.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Co-Chair. I'm just, you know, thinking of the situation of a shopkeeper of a recreational store who, you know, when, say, 4 o'clock rolls around in the afternoon, you've got a bunch of looky-loos coming from the local middle school or high school, you know, a bunch of kids walking home, you know, who decide to go in and take a look at the wares, and, you know, suddenly you've got 8-10 kids in there, you know, and that's going to happen. I'm just trying to figure out if that's a savory situation or not, you know.
Would it be feasible? I mean, do you think it would pass muster in the Cole context if all stores were required to check at the door, to card people at the door? And then if they had a violation, they would have to do the second step. Do you think that would pass muster with Cole?
Yeah. Madam Co-Chair, I do believe that would be feasible. And, you know, just for clarification, my understanding is that retailers operating in Colorado and Washington are checking at the door as a business practice almost uniformly, although it may not be affirmatively required by the law. And also, I would like to make a point regarding the minor postings. This is something that will be clarified in administrative rule, but I think it's fair to say that the OLCC's intention at this point is to prohibit minors at all times from retail establishments. So what we're really talking about now are affirmative duties that would be placed on the licensees beyond that general prohibition.
Representative Buckley.
Hi, Madam Chair. And that's a great point. I mean, I could see a facility that did have a very clear posting, no minors allowed. And in Representative Wilson's example, if the gaggle of middle school kids wanted to go in and look at the wares, the shop operator would have the option to simply say, I'm sorry, there's no minors allowed. You can't come in. If they say they're over 21, at that point you could say, well, then I need to see some ID, and they could be escorted out. So that to me seems like a workable system.
Yes.
Other comments from the committee? So if we did, I mean, it seems to me that if we did have a check at the door for minors, and if that works, then that's all the further you go. And if there's a problem, then you can go the next step. Is that, is it making sense? Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to wait for Representative Olson to give his opinion, but it appears I'm going to have to wait forever.
Well, that's not been my experience.
I think Jesse, you answered my question, which is, in my experience in going in and out of the liquor stores that I've frequented over the years, they're typically small enough for staff to be able to see who's coming in and out. And I think for their own protection, they are watching to see if somebody looks like a minor and immediately intercepting that person if they're not accompanied by a parent or somebody of age. I don't understand why that wouldn't be the practice even in a marijuana retail establishment. And for their own protection, they would want to self-regulate in that manner. And since it's likely that the entire facility is going to be visible, or most of it, from the desk, much like a liquor store, we'd be able to catch those looky-loos on their way in and card them then, instead of having a proactive need for potentially an additional employee to do that function, and then have it happen again at the desk. So I would be in favor of the scenario that Representative Buckley explained,
which is basically only carding people if you had reason to believe they were underage, but you have no problem with banning minors from the establishment.
And isn't that a separate issue that we're going to take up?
I think that's kind of inherent in this.
If I may, Madam Co-Chair, I agree it is inherent in this. We have existing authority under the measure to assign a minor posting, and as I previously stated, I believe we have every intention of assigning a minor posting that would prohibit minors at all times in marijuana licenses.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, yeah, I think the minor posting is great. I'm just concerned about the increased overhead of having an assigned door person. I just don't think that works from a commerce standpoint. So.
Well, if you had a situation where these are going to be small shops, I assume, not huge shops. So how would you do it then, Representative Wilson? Would you check it all?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, again, I would just have a minor posting and not have a door person, and have the person or persons who are working behind the counter in charge of enforcing the minor posting.
Madam Chair, one question. Why is it that you think that these are going to be small shops?
Well, I'm just because liquor stores are small.
You don't know.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
Know.
I mean, they're going to have to deal with that.
Senator Pisanski.
I mean, if they're a box store, they're going to have the employees. Let's just face it. I mean, it seems to me, taking this on a kind of a more systematic basis, you require the posting, then you have a duty on the owner, operator, employees to enforce that. And if they don't take the steps, I expect OLCC is going to be telling them they're not doing a good job, and they're going to either sanction them or have them go through some other process. And then requiring the AVE on without any violations, that seems somewhat over-conservative as compared to if there is a problem, then they have to take those steps.
So they would have an incentive not to let people in.
Well, yeah, first they got their license, they're going to be in jeopardy. They're going to be sanctioned in the sense of potentially having these fines, and what's proposed, I'm not saying I'm there, but it could go up to $5,000 depending on what type of metrics they might have. And then also requiring them to buy additional equipment, which we don't know what it costs, but it sounds like some people are thinking, well, I'd rather take the monetary fine than buying this equipment, so it's got to be somewhat expensive. And also it probably also puts it in a scenario that you may actually impact your customer clientele. If they know every time they got to come in, they got to give their ID to get a product, they may want to go down to the next retail shop. So I think there's an incentive to comply.
And that's what you're finding in the state of Washington, I gather? That people are finding it in their best interest to make sure they don't let minors...
Yeah. Madam Co-Chair, the state of Washington prohibits people from under age of 21 from entering a retail premises. My understanding, and this is anecdotal, but my understanding of the business practices there is that most businesses are employing an IG checker at the door.
But it's not required.
Yes.
Senator Ferriol.
I think all of us may be having difficulty imagining what these retail environments would look like. There's an HBO news series called Vice, and they've done a television show, on a 45-minute show on the more mature recreational cannabis business in Colorado. And one of the interesting shots is in the first few weeks of recreational sales, there were lines around the block for accessing recreational marijuana. In the first week of access, whenever that occurs, there will be 500,000 customers who visit a marijuana recreational site in Oregon, because those are current users from the diversion of product from other markets. And one of the interesting features of that business is that the folks who were doing the medical side experienced a exponential increase in their business. One of the grow facilities with a retail and a medical co-location was 22,000 square feet, and they were expanding into a neighboring building which would add another 22,000 square feet of grow area. And so, you know, these operations are far more extensive than I think we envision them at the present time. And the person at the door was a flak jacketed armed special forces security agent who had a 45 and an AR-15, not because of the quality of the clientele, which are ordinary citizens, but because the business is an entry point for virtually unlimited cash. So the question of, you know, checking folks at the door becomes subsidiary to the question of security, because these folks don't have access to the banking community.
Yeah, but that's a good point. Let's try not to get too far off the
I'm going back to the checking people at the door. So yeah, what I'm really envisioning is what happens at a retail establishment that's got 150 people standing in line at the doorway and a limited floor space. So you have to actually monitor who leaves so that you can let the next customer in, checking their ID, but also maintaining the kind of security that is quite evident in other places that has to be maintained on a 24-hour basis. I think checking their ID at the door is probably the least of the issues.
Okay. So what I'm hearing from the committee is not wanting to put people through a double check unless there's a reason to do so, to post the area against any minors coming in, and to leave it to the business owner how to accomplish that. And if they don't accomplish that, then they have to go to stage two. Am I seeing nodding heads up?
And look, Madam Chair, we can always come back in February if we need to fix it, especially if you have several different drug rip-offs in the process.
Okay, we're just trying to get a product here for everybody to look at, okay? All right, let's move on to the next one.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Moving on, the next item is background checks. And I will be speaking primarily to what we currently do for applicants for liquor licenses. OLCC has requested authority to require fingerprints from marijuana license applicants in order to perform nationwide criminal background checks. And the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 844 propose to grant OLCC this authority. For liquor licenses, OLCC performs background checks for every applicant for an annual liquor license. We also selectively perform checks on other individuals associated with the liquor license when we believe they may be involved with criminal activity. applicants who are sole proprietors and members of legal entities identified in rule are required to submit individual history forms. OLCC staff use the information in these forms to run in-state background checks using LEDS terminals to access Oregon DMV and criminal records. When processing license applications, staff are unable to access national databases through the LEDS system. In order to access a national database at the licensing stage, staff require fingerprint information from the applicant. That's my understanding after conversations with OSP. We do have authorization in Chapter 471 to require applicants for certain on-premise licenses to submit fingerprint information. However, due to cost concerns and other administrative concerns, we do not currently utilize that authority for liquor licenses. As I mentioned, we do run background checks on certain investors and managers at staff's discretion when we believe that we have a reason to do so, and these checks are also in-state checks using the LEDS database. Measure 91 specifically states that OLCC may deny an applicant who has been convicted of violating a law of this state, another state, or violating federal law. OLCC has requested the broadest authority possible to do the highest level of background checks for marijuana applicants. And the agency believes that in order to effectively fulfill our obligations under the measure, we need the authority to obtain fingerprints, which would allow us to access the national databases. The requested authority is similar to what we have for liquor. And we believe that this is especially important in the context of marijuana. Organized crime is known to have existing interest in the illegal drug trade, and these interests cross state lines freely. The ability to perform nationwide background checks would allow an enhanced opportunity to prevent individuals associated with organized crime from being licensed in the recreational marijuana industry. This speaks directly to one of the points of the Cole memo as well. We believe that the mere ability to perform such checks would serve as a deterrent in addition to what we actually find when we do the checks. So the document presents two policy options. One is to provide OLCC additional authority to require fingerprints that would allow us to access the national databases. The section option, which is listed as an option, although it's, I think, fair to say not a recommendation, is that we change the denial criteria in the statute to limit it to crimes committed in Oregon, because what we have right now is a situation where we can deny for crimes outside of Oregon and for federal crimes, but we lack the necessary tools to access the databases to discover those crimes. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm confused by this option, too. Is this aimed at, for example, if you do the national search and you find that somebody has a conviction in another state for something that would not be a crime in Oregon, i.e. specifically affecting marijuana, somebody has a misdemeanor or a felony in another state for something that wouldn't be a crime in Oregon, that you could still grant them a license? Is that what you were talking about?
Madam Co-Chair, I think that the point of listing the option two is simply to illustrate that our authority to do background checks does not match the denial criteria which are identified in statute. And I would also like to add that any conviction, felony or misdemeanor, must be relevant to the exercise of the license privilege.
Senator Pazansky.
Yeah, Madam Chair, number two is basically, if we don't give them the option on number one, we need to change the criteria, is what they're saying, so it will match up to what they can actually do. Okay. What I do want to ask, though, I know as a prosecutor, I have access to NCIC, I believe it is, and Representative Olson may be able to help me on this, but we do checks in the sense of they'll do a check on the, first through the LEDs, and then they'll print out the other one, and that will tell us what's going on. I know they got SID numbers or stuff like that, or cross references. But the fingerprint is, I'm just not sure what databases that might be opening up, and maybe that's something OSP can give us a little bit of information on.
At NICS, it would open up NICS.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Pruzanski, we are in the process of working out our options for implementation. We have had discussions with OSP, and we're having further discussions. One of the things that we have found is the access to these databases is dependent on how they are used. So, for example, with the LEDS database, you're going to get different access when you're investigating a license application than you are when you're investigating a criminal act after the fact.
Yep, there are different levels. Yep.
Okay, so what's the sense of the committee here? Fingerprints? Fingerprints. Number one. Okay. Anybody disagree with that? All right. Okay, moving on.
With that, I would like to introduce Nathan Ricks, who is a policy analyst with OLCC's marijuana program, and he will speak to you regarding edibles.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Ricks, and I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and speak tonight. I'd like to do three things today. First, describe to you our approach in discussing the edibles subject we have here today, some of the homework that you had assigned us from our last committee meeting. And second, explain the need for the delay in edibles. And third, explain to you our engagement, the who, what, where, and how of how we plan on meeting the new timeline that we propose. So first, in our approach, what we've done to understand and wrap our minds around the what edibles are, we've engaged with Colorado. We've taken one staff trip there. Most recently, we went to Washington and asked a lot of questions about what they've learned in their rulemaking process, which is, turns out has been quite iterative. They've revised their edible rule several times and are in the middle of actually implementing an emergency revision to their edible rules. We're also interfacing with our Oregon Department of Agriculture and OHA, as well as trying to figure out how to best utilize the existing labs programs to figure out how we might end up testing edibles. We've conducted 11 listening sessions, which you have the report in your packet, and gathered a lot of public input about what edibles should look like. And we've also conducted quite a bit of internal staff research. So we've really entered into quite a big question phase, which we'll be continuing over the next few months. So before I launch into describing in a little more detail what's in your packet in Attachment E, I guess the main concept that I wish to convey to you today is that sequencing matters. One of the issues that comes to the forefront of the edibles issue is packaging and testing. And we think that really up front, those two issues are on the forefront of our mind and need to be dealt with first before we deal directly with edibles. We take really seriously the cautions that we've heard from Colorado and Washington, and that that a change in a rule means an immediate change for the manufacturer and those that are actually producing the edibles. They've seen quite a bit of frustration there as they've changed the rules. It's required the manufacturer and edible maker to make that change, which is a cost to the industry and a cost to the licensee. So we want to prevent as much of that on the front end as we can. Ultimately, we want to get as much right on the front end as we can. So OLCC has identified a number of policy issues that we feel should be addressed prior to the adoption of rules and the approval of licenses which manufacture edible marijuana products. And the questions you see here in Attachment E, we've bulleted out for you. The first question is, how much THC should be in any one edible marijuana serving? And what we've learned from some of our research is that both Colorado and Washington have settled on a rate of 10 micrograms per serving. There's little conclusive scientific evidence to support this number, but what we've done is we've already started talking to the Oregon Health Authority to convene a panel of experts to try and answer this question, and we should have some preliminary answers soon. Another question that we've asked is...
Let me just correct you. Our staff administrator just pointed out it's actually milligrams, not micrograms, in Colorado.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you. Milligrams. A second question that we've begun to ask is how many servings should there be in one product? And some edible products and available in the OMMP dispensaries contain 500 micrograms of THC.
It's actually milligrams again.
Milligrams. Pardon me. Milligrams of THC or more. And this translates into 50 servings in a single product. OLCC has asked OHA for advice on this issue as well. Both Colorado and Washington have set a maximum of 10 servings per product or a sum total of 100 milligrams of THC. Another question, how should these products be labeled with respect to marijuana? Colorado just completed its third change to its labeling rules for edible product. As I mentioned earlier, Washington is undergoing another iteration of its rules regarding labeling. Each time a change has been made to the edible manufacturers, edible manufacturers have had to make new packaging changes in their labels to meet the new rules. What labeling should be in place for the underlying food product? OLCC staff is currently working with DOA and OHA to address this issue. What types of testing should be done on edible products? OLCC intends to require potency testing and is working with food experts to understand what other tests should be in place before a product can be considered safe. Just to elaborate on that a little more, one learning that we learned just yesterday in Olympia that's being addressed in some of the emergency rules is that if you heat up an edible product, it actually can increase the potency. And so that's something new that we learned that Washington in early implementation was not aware of, and so they're having to go back and make some revisions there.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Senator Cruz.
When we were looking at your testing work group, we were assuming one-stop shopping so that the testing labs would not be just testing pot, they would be testing all products. So keep that in mind that will probably end up in public health because they're the ones that do most of the testing. So, but it makes sense that all the testing that's going to be necessary is in one place. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, thank you. And we've already initiated some of the first conversations with the labs. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, I don't want to stall this thing or get on a rabbit trail, but when we talk about convening a panel of experts, and I know everybody around here operates out of self-interest and has a biased opinion, but I could probably pull five people out of this audience right now who would get you a long way down the road on that when you're looking for a panel of experts. So I would just say I would hope that as we begin talking about panel of experts, we're talking to the right people here who have known these things for decades, and it's not new to them. So just a thought.
Thank you for that.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wilson, one other group that we hope to engage in this conversation, in addition to the labs, is in a subgroup of our rules advisory process. One group we're looking to group of folks to appoint are actually around advertising, labeling, and kitchens, which will deal directly with the edible issue.
Okay, let's move quickly through the rest of this.
Another question, what type of safety warnings should be included? Colorado requires that its products indicate how many doses are in each package, how long it will take before the product will affect the consumer, and warning labels aimed at children. OLCC has asked OHA for help in developing these standards. Another question, what type of products will be allowed? The rules drafted by both Colorado and Washington are possible models, but OLCC wishes to work with experts in child behavior to assure that products sold in OLCC licensed retail establishments cannot be confused with non-marijuana products. There's also the issue of advertising, what types of advertising products should be allowed on the products, how the products look, and the branding need to be defined by rule to assure it's both accurate and does not appeal to children. So, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, in summary, the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 844 propose to give the OLCC an additional year to adopt rules related to edibles. The provision helps align expectations with the complexity of the issues and grants the agency the necessary time to get the rules right. OLCC intends to move as quickly as possible to adopt the rules and make edible products available in the recreational market.
Okay. You give the options here to delay or not to delay, but it doesn't have to be a year. It could be 6 months. Is that correct? It could be someplace in between. How's it represented, Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for compiling the list. I appreciate it. Again, I echo my colleague here. I looked through the list of questions, and really after seeing the examples that were samples that are provided for us from Colorado in one of the earlier hearings, and I just I'm still not quite clear why it would take a year even to resolve these questions when we have people already in our state producing edibles, packaging edibles. I think a work group could be convened on this, part of your Rules Advisory Committee, a subcommittee, that could get this resolved. None of these seem to be insurmountable issues to tackle. When you do have insists, like, for instance, that you want to have the research done on the proper serving, well, I don't know, going down that road, given the fact that there has not been substantial research done, you might want to take advantage of the expertise that's been developed through the medical marijuana program as a way to try to address that, given the lack of scientific peer-reviewed research. But again, I look down this list, and I'm wondering, we in the legislature, we tackle complex issues in several months' time and find a way to resolve them. I'm just not seeing on this list what is insurmountable and what can't be done in a just a regular process over the course of the next stretch of time. So that's my feeling after looking at the list. Madam Co-Chair, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Other comments, Senator Pazansky.
Madam Chair, we also understand the way that the OLCC has proposed to actually do licenses, and we have four different ones we're looking at now, if not five. This one seems like it's going to be further down the road than the production of actually producing the cannabis that's going to be used in the edibles. So it seems to me that there's going to be already not a delay, but it's not going to need to be ready on January 1 or January 4, 2016 anyway. And so I think that I have not seen the reasons why we would grant another full year without more showing. Again, I think as we've heard from some of the representatives, there's people in this room, there's people, other people in the state that are doing this that could actually be part of that RAC and have multiple subcommittees, just like we do here, to get this expertise information and be able to move forward. And they can always adjust it if we see more coming out of Colorado or Washington State that causes us a need to do whatever at that point. Plus, we have another session in February.
Right. Okay. I think you're getting a signal here. I hope you pay attention to it. Okay, let's move on. Scope of peace officer, is that you, Jesse?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Moving on to this subject, I'd like to invite DOJ up to the table.
Okay. Thank you. Are there parting questions before they leave the dais? Okay, thank you.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, we have Herb Lovejoy and Shannon O'Fallon with us from DOJ. Mr. Lovejoy will speak to some of the legal issues regarding the peace officer authority, and I will be available to speak to the OLCC's exercise of this authority in the liquor realm. Following that, Ms. O'Fallon will speak to some questions of definitions in Measure 91.
Thank you. Welcome.
Co-chairs Burdick and Leininger and vice chairs Prozonsky and Wilson, members of the committee. My name is Herbert Lovejoy. I'm a senior assistant attorney general.
Got someone.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry. I didn't see the sign there. Members of the committee, my name is Herbert Lovejoy. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm also the assistant attorney in charge of the government services section. And that is the section that is is General Contact Counsel for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Before I begin, I do want to just say that I'm here to address the legal issues on behalf of OLCC and the Peace Officer Authority, not to address the policy considerations as far as the bill on behalf of the Department of Justice. In your packet of materials that was provided to you, you have a memorandum from Heather Vogelsong, who's Assistant Attorney General, and I have been working with her somewhat tangentially on some of the issues facing OLCC concerning the scope of Liquor Enforcement Inspector's Peace Officer Authority on the alcohol side of the equation. I'm not going to repeat what's in the memo, just to kind of touch very quickly on some of the issues. The bottom line is that the definitions of liquor enforcement inspector is found in OLCC's organic statutes in Chapter 471. And the liquor enforcement inspector under 471.001 talks about those individuals being employees of the commission authorized to act. So they're agents of OLCC. And also that the commission, their authority is to enforce, among other things, commission rules and other statutes that the commission considers related to alcoholic liquor. That is also dovetailed into another statute within Chapter 471, which is 471.775, again, dovetailing into the issue of what the commission considers related to alcoholic liquor. So we've done what the Oregon Supreme Court calls a PGE analysis of the organic statutes and the peace officer authority that the legislature has granted these individuals. And the bottom line is that the specific governs the general. And so in other areas of the law, such as ORS Chapter 133 and Chapter 153, that talks about peace officer authorities to issue citations, make arrests, and that sort of thing, those generally talk about the actions that individual peace officers can take, but they don't talk about the context under which what laws they're enforcing. And so we go back to what is the organic authority of these individuals, and we come back to Chapter 471, and it's alcohol related. And so the bottom line of the memorandum, the punchline, if you will, is that the scope of the liquor enforcement inspector's peace officer authority is limited to those situations where they're enforcing alcohol related laws. So if there's something outside of alcohol related laws, like a possession of controlled substance or a domestic violence kind of crime, they would not have the authority to go ahead and do an arrest, issue a citation, that type of thing. They would have to call in someone like a police officer, sheriff's deputy, someone with more broader general peace officer authority to go ahead and make those arrests, make those citations, that type of thing. And so that's what the memo talks about as far as what current law is for the alcohol side of OLCC and their liquor enforcement inspectors. Any questions?
Okay.
Question.
Right here.
Senator Farioli.
No, I'm directing you to the House side.
He's pushing you to the House.
I'm pushing you over to the House. Representative Buckley.
Well, yes. Well, sure. Thank you.
Somebody.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just curious, how far are you going to go with this? I mean, for the training in this part, I mean, are they going to be certified as DPSST certifies police officers? Those are kind of some questions I have.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Olson. Our intention, if we were granted this authority for marijuana, is to have our marijuana inspectors or any existing inspector who handles marijuana to go through a DPSST certification before going out and doing this work. And we've had some, we've done some initial staff work in figuring out what that would look like, and we're continuing to work on that.
So follow up on that, yeah. Are you planning on doing the full 16-week class that they do right now for law enforcement?
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Olson, yes. And we are also looking at developing a special module within there to deal with the marijuana issues.
Thank you, sworn officers.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Pazansky.
So you're saying these inspectors are going to be sworn police officers if they're going through a 16-week class as compared to going through a special inspector school for marijuana? Because what I just...
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Pruszynski, I may need to follow up on the specifics of that point.
Yeah, because yeah. I mean, if they're going through the full 16-week course, they're becoming sworn police officers that could be in any police department or agency in the state, as compared to what I understand the alcohol inspectors are going through a course and getting certified through DPSST, but not as a full sworn police officer.
Okay. So just follow up with that. I hear what you're saying, Senator, and Madam Chair. What I heard Herb say specifically, I mean, with this 471.775, Section 2 specifically, I see you're going to have some conflict.
Shannon, do you have any insight on this?
Lifeline.
Madam Co-Chair, I do not. This
Can you
is
identify
not, I
mean, yourself for the record?
Right. Oh, sorry. Shannon O'Fallon from Department of Justice. I mean, this is an issue that has arisen because, you know, Measure 91 is, you know, modeled after the alcohol statutes, but didn't take all of the alcohol statutes. It's not exactly the same. And so this is one of those differences, which again indicates that on the marijuana side, there's not the same peace officer authority. But other than that, I only know what Heather wrote in her memo.
Okay. Sorry to put you on the spot there. This has been something we've been struggling with for a while. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Well, in addition to the need to clarify the training requirements and exactly what these agents be, I'm a little confused by the memo in that it talks about that the authority is granted to liquor into liquor control law enforcement. Then basically the memo is saying, in practice, though, they focus their enforcement on activities related to licensed premises. If I'm reading this right, means that they could actually expand their enforcement activities, but in practice they don't. And the memo has two options, which I don't know whether OLC was going to get to the two options. One would be to provide OLC the same authority as alcohol, which, just so I understand it, would mean that we'd be giving them, obviously, the ability to enforce regulations around premises, but the option, if they should so decide, to also branch out beyond premises to any violation that might be related to the laws surrounding recreational marijuana, such as if someone is smoking marijuana in public, etc. Am I understanding that correctly? Is that the correct understanding?
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Buckley, if I may, what the memo attempts to describe, and you know, I tried to come and provide clarity on this issue, and it seems that I'm only adding more questions. But what the memo attempts to describe is how we exercise our authority that Mr. Lovejoy has spoken to. We have authority to not only enforce in our liquor licenses, but we have authority to enforce any liquor law in the state of Oregon, regardless of where that violation occurs. In practice, the OLCC is not out there going after moonshiners,
right?
Although technically we have the legal authority to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the purpose of the memo, and that's the purpose of the options. Option one is the broader option than option two. Option one, if we were to carry over identical language that's or very similar language to Chapter 471, would give us authority to enforce all marijuana laws in the state of Oregon. And I don't know let me stop there. Option two would grant us the necessary peace officer authority to do our compliance work, but it would limit us not only in subject matter, but also it would limit us to certain locations and individuals. It would limit us to licensees, employees, and activities associated with a licensed premises.
Thank you, Mr. Follow, Madam Gutcher. Thank you very much. And just to clarify, I appreciate that answer. So if you bring it out so broad as, say, all marijuana laws in the state of Oregon, that could conceivably mean someone who's growing under Measure 91, the four plants in their own home. That could mean that there might be enforcement capabilities there instead of with local police. And it also could mean conceivably the medical marijuana program, since that is under Oregon law and marijuana under Oregon law. So I just want to clarify if that is an accurate statement.
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Buckley, I think we would need some detailed analysis on that, but if the language were broad enough, conceivably it could include all of that activity.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Leininger.
Thank you so much for being here, and we should probably offer to get you some water pretty soon because you've been on the hot seat for a while. I had a really unusual constituent meeting earlier today in which two representatives of Lewis and Clark student government came to my office to describe some concerns that they had about OLCC enforcement authority use in and around Lewis and Clark campus. And the stories they relayed were actually, they were very troubling in the context of what we're talking about. So I need you to know them. It sounds like they're very concerned about unmarked cars and ununiformed officers sort of driving slowly all around their campus area. And one of the women was describing that she was walking from one, not from a party, from a friend's house to her own home at night once. And this car started following her. And then she started to run because she was afraid and she was alone and it was at night and it was an unmarked car. And the car sped up, pulled around in front of her, stopped to block her path, and two guys jumped out, and they were OLCC staff, and they said to her, and she was afraid, you know, she thought something terrible was going to happen, and she tried to, she wanted to leave, and they said, if you leave, we'll arrest you. And then the two student government representatives, of whom this was one, said, and this is not an isolated incident, and, you know, students of color, the other was a student of color. He said, you know, students of color are really worried that they're being trailed and then these law enforcement people, you know, might visit dire consequences on them and they don't know what their rights are. And then they also said to me they're concerned because the OLCC representatives issue MIPs, minor in possession sort of citations without doing field sobriety tests first. And so they'll go, sometimes they will go into a large room where there's an event and they'll just give everyone an MIP, even if not everyone there is even involved with alcohol. So it was serendipity in a terrible way to hear from these constituents who were, you know, student government representatives from a university that's well respected in my district, you know, at exactly the moment that we're hearing about possible enlargement of OLCC enforcement authority, and I'm wondering how we can address those issues, which is another conversation, but how can we help people feel confident that this is not going to open up a lot of concerns for their well-being and their privacy and safety?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
You know what? I tell them file a personnel complaint. That's what I do.
Yeah. The past several years at the OLCC, we have seen what I believe are some really positive changes, and we're working at improving our relationships with constituents, with local governments. I would encourage your constituents to contact myself or Director Marks at the OLCC. We will put them in touch with the right people. We will address these concerns. And that's probably the extent of my comments on that issue.
Okay, let me break in here in the interest of time. I'm getting the sense from the committee that people are very nervous about having broad, overarching authority.
Option two.
Okay, I'm getting the sense from the committee that they prefer option two. But furthermore, I would like to ask Senator Prezansky and Representative Olson to get together with you and get to the bottom of this training issue. And I think the sense of the committee expressed earlier is we wanted to be consistent with what's going on in alcohol. We didn't want some different standard for people who are dealing with marijuana. Is this the sense of the committee?
Well, may I? I mean, I would say based on the conversation I had earlier today, I'm not looking to replicate at least what my constituents' experience is for alcohol. So
right. And that's, yes. You know, Senator Cruz.
But as I understand it, on the alcohol side, I mean, they theoretically have jurisdiction to go into an underage party and deal with that. They just don't do it. I don't want.
Right, but what we're talking about is limiting them.
Well, they do something, but I don't want to be too restrictive in this. So they need to be able to, you know, potentially go to the licensed grows and mm-hmm. and that sort of thing too. So it needs to be. We don't want to give them incredible power, but we want to make sure it's flexible enough to do the job they need to do.
Right.
So,
if you look at option two, I think it's pretty much what you just talked about is included there. Senator Pazansky?
Yeah, we can call that out. I mean, licensed premises, I know they're using that in different terms. I mean, to me, that seems to be more in the discussion of with alcohol as outlets, you know, the actual places. But I understand we want to ensure that they can go to any of the four licensed places that are under the marijuana and have enforcement action to those. What we don't want is them to be knocking on someone's door and saying we want to see your home grow.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. So that's we just established legislative history, and hopefully we will have the amendment that reflects that. Okay, let's move on to Shannon's presentation, I believe, is next.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Shannon O'Fallon again with the Department of Justice. I'll try to go through this quickly. So I want to address some of the issues that have been noted in the definitions in Measure 91, particularly around the definition of what a marijuana extract is. So I think you're aware.
Can you put us where we're at in this page?
So
are we after the memo on January 7th?
The last,
attachment G?
Part of G.
Attachment G. About the third page?
Attachment G. Yeah, sorry.
Starting after the memo.
Right. So the definition, in Measure 91, the definition of extract says that an extract is something that's, you know, made using a hydrocarbon-based solvent. And that if it's, and I'm paraphrasing, if it's made with something like vegetable glycerin, then it's not considered a marijuana extract. And again, my understanding of different processes by which substances are made from marijuana, you can still have very concentrated, you can have a substance with very concentrated levels of THC that are made, you know, through some other process that doesn't use these more dangerous solvents. And it's not clear under the measure sort of what category those substances would be in. The definition of marijuana products talks about things that are, you know, sort of infused with an extract or are marijuana or something else. Again, it's not clear if something that's not an extract but is still, you know, what if you look at the definitions, is called a concentrate. It's not sure where that falls. That's important sort of for two reasons, you know, depending on how you look at the definitions and where you decide that sort of concentrate falls. If a concentrate is not considered actually a medical marijuana product, then in fact a licensee, an OLCC licensee, couldn't process anything with that concentrate in it. So that could be a problem. If it is a marijuana product, then under Section 6, that where you talk about the personal possession limits, you could theoretically have 72 ounces of a concentrate in a liquid form, again, which my understanding is this would be, that would be a lot of something that's very concentrated. And it's, of course, a policy decision, you know, whether or not any of those limits want to be changed. So what we've attempted to do is come up with some definitions that maybe address this, again, without, hopefully without changing the intent of the measure, but just to add clarification. So the definition of marijuana items would be amended to include marijuana concentrate that we've also defined. And essentially what we've done is said a marijuana extract is something that's made through sort of, you know, the more dangerous methods that really only an OLCC licensee should be able to do under the rules of the commission. A concentrate is something that you could make at home that's not dangerous to make. Something that's made through mechanical processes or with vegetable glycerin or with water, things like that. So again, a marijuana item would include a marijuana concentrate, which means then that an OLCC licensee could process a marijuana concentrate. The definition of marijuana products is sort of expanded. Right now it talks about things that are intended for human consumption, but doesn't cover things that are intended for other use. Could be topicals, could be something that you would inhale. So it's broadened to make it clear that it would be any product that's intended for human consumption or use, any product that contains cannabinoids, and anything into which, you know, marijuana, usable marijuana, marijuana extracts or marijuana concentrates is included. But it would not include marijuana by itself, usable marijuana by itself, marijuana concentrates or marijuana extracts by itself. Because, you know, you have all these now sort of new categories of marijuana, it's proposed that the definition of usable marijuana be changed. Right now, the definition of usable marijuana says, you know, the dried leaves or flowers or any sort of combination or preparation thereof. And I think that the definition of marijuana products sort of covers that ground. So usable marijuana would be flowers or leaves or any combination of flowers and leaves. What else? Because we have these new categories, it is proposed that Section 6 of Measure 91 would be amended to permit a certain amount of a marijuana concentrate to be in a household. The amendment that you have before you says 1 ounce. You know, that was, we just took the same amount, I think, as you could possess through an extract if you think that's right. So that's the highlight.
Okay, so on this, on the extracts, that would be 1 ounce in addition to allowable flower, or how would that work?
Right, so Section 6 then would allow you to have 8 ounces, so four plants, 8 ounces of usable marijuana, 16 ounces of marijuana products in a solid form, 72 ounces of marijuana products in a liquid form, and then 1 ounce of marijuana concentrate. In Section, I think, 57 of the measure, if I'm remembering correctly, it prohibits homemade extracts. And so that provision can remain untouched because of the way that extracts is defined.
I've always wondered, so you could have all of those things, the concentrate plus the flowers plus the other things.
Madam Co-Chair, my reading is that they're not exclusive. You could have all of those at the same time.
I've wondered about the 72 ounces of liquid. It doesn't really say. I've never been able to see anything that says how concentrated the liquid would be.
That would be a point.
What are your thoughts on that?
Great. So, Madam Co-Chair, I mean, what I saw in Colorado when I you know, went there to learn about their process was, you know, there are processors that are making drinks with marijuana, with extracts or concentrates in them. So maybe that's what it means, but not having drafted the measure, I'm not positive what the intent was there.
Well, I wonder if it would be possible to agree on a level that would make sense for liquids, a dilution level, if you will, because obviously it's different. You know, I suppose these very, very highly concentrated products could count as a liquid at some point. So, Representative Buckley, help us out here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would hope that we'd actually talk to some of the producers. Yeah. Again, I think the different products, there's a distinction in a concentrate and a liquid that's infused. I know that there's a company in Bend, for instance, that wants to produce like a root beer that's infused with cannabis. I think it's a different process. different potency. And I would hope that we'd get feedback from the drafters of Measure 91 on their intent, and also from the industry itself too, to get clarification.
Yeah, I would really like that too, because there'd be a lot of difference between a can of root beer that was infused, that one can is the dose, versus a can where one sip is the dose. And I guess that's what I was trying to get at. Senator Pisanski.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, this really is not a technical fix. This is a policy decision. I would ask you to table or parking lot this, and let us have the discussions we need to have, because now we're getting into putting stuff into a technical fix bill that really has not been deliberated by us, by allowing for the general public to give comment. And that's what I would expect to be either Senate Bill 936, House Bill 3400, or whatever bill we use to go forward.
Well, are you talking about the other, like the definitions as well?
Well, some of them, I mean, this, what I'm hearing right now, if we're going to start identifying what these definitions are and what the recommendations are, we're going to start making policy decisions as to what the potency is or the level and stuff like that. And that just does not seem necessary for the technical fix bill.
I would agree.
Yeah. Same.
Does OLCC have thoughts on that, on how urgent this is? Because some of these definitely are policy. I mean,
Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee, if I may, if we are talking about potency levels and definitions of different products, I certainly would agree with Senator Pisanski that we're moving out of the technical realm. Mm-hmm. I think there is some room to address these questions in rulemaking. Going back to the technical realm, I think there is a technical problem with these extracts that are produced without the use of solvents, because they don't really have a home in the existing definitions. We're talking about hash that is manufactured through mechanical process, non-solvent extracts, if you will. So Ms. O'Fallon drafted some definitions on our at our request to define those products as concentrates and to make it clear that we have regulatory authority over those products and that they can be sold at licensed premises.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a shot? And again, whatever we come up with, we'll have a hearing, so people will be able to comment on it. Why don't we take a shot at putting the definition in for some of these things that don't have a home, and seeing if we can limit it to that, and then stay away from the policy potency discussion. And that is the committee comfortable with that?
Madam Chair,
Senator Pisanski.
The stuff I went through on the dash ones, we still have to go through. We're going to pick up some of this discussion there as to definitions that were in 936 and 3400. Instead of having, like, the marijuana extract, it's the cannabinoids extracts and stuff like that. So I would, again, encourage us. Clearly, we're going to give the authority for them to be able to regulate. Mm-hmm. That they can walk away from tonight. But going into these specifics, it seems to me we need to have more discussions before we actually make a decision on this for at this point.
Even on the definition, even on the early part of this, you don't see anything of this that you would consider appropriate?
I guess this is the first time for me to see this document. Mm-hmm. I would like to absorb what we have here before I start taking a position and definitively on this. And
it seems I'm just trying to figure out what to put in the amendment at this point. If something is clearly inappropriate to put in, then let's not do it like the potency stuff. I think you make a good case. But if we've got things that are worth considering putting in, I'd like to, especially if we have marijuana products that don't have a legal home. That is kind of persuasive to me.
Madam Chair, I have no problem with OLCC trying to refine the definitions. If we don't like them, we don't have to accept them. So. Yeah. I mean, you know, if we want to go a different direction, that's certainly our prerogative at that point. But at this point, Madam Chair, we shouldn't say no to any help we can get on some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would agree with what's being said here. We've come a long way, and we're beginning to establish the connective tissues that that work here. But I want to make sure that we're operating under real-world conditions here as we begin to define things and put the bow on this. And so I would just encourage us to go slow and talk to those people who operate in the real world with this and get some wisdom from the people who actually know what they're talking about on this stuff.
I completely agree. Yeah. Shannon, did you have comments on this?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, just one more thing. So the Dash 1 amendments do, I mean, it takes a slightly different tact. It does amend the definition of marijuana extract and then says what a marijuana extract is and what a marijuana extract isn't, and then sort of refers to the second part of the definition when it's talking about what is essentially what I'm calling a concentrate. So, I mean, maybe, it could be that we're suggesting a slightly different tact to what's already in the Dash 1s, I think, for just the issue of how marijuana extract is defined and then how a concentrate is defined.
But both of them, both your approach and that approach does it. Why don't we take a shot at that?
Okay.
Stay away from the definition of the liquids and so on. Okay. What else do we have here?
I think we've completed what they were going to give to us. What I would suggest, if we have time, is maybe go through what myself and Adam went through and identify these other items that way, because I don't think this just went up on OLIS from what I understand this afternoon.
Correct.
And so this would give Shannon and others an opportunity to kind of look at maybe some integration of some of the other stuff so we can move further down.
I agree, and we have time to do you because you're so quick and efficient. Senator, let's move on to Senator Pruszanski. Do you want to go down
Adam's
there?
Or
do you
want
to just have Adam
stay
do
here.
It? Okay. Adam.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, the document in front of you is a three-page document that sequentially takes in order the proposed changes Senator Pruszanski identified as potential areas for improvement and the Dash 1 amendments. Taking it from the top and continuing the discussion we just had, within Section 1, page 3, lines 12 through 15, the definition of a marijuana extract, the proposed action is to remove the definition of marijuana extract and replace it with the definition of cannabis extract found either in House Bill 3400 or Senate Bill 936.
And then also, if you remember, we had testimony as to maybe needing to incorporate a broader definition as to incorporating the use of heat on low heat versus high heat for the extractions. And so you can have the ability to carry out the extraction at home and still be at a safe level without placing others or property or individuals at risk. So that's the item underneath there for further discussion.
How would you manage that?
Well, the way that we've heard from Mr. Delato, that was the one that brought this to our attention, is that you would pick a temperature and say that if so long as it's low heat below whatever that definition is, and I think they were saying 160 or 180, that it would be considered non-hazardous and would not be a required the license to do the extraction as if you had a processing license.
I guess I understand that from their perspective. I don't understand how you would enforce that.
Are we talking home grows here?
Yep.
And they're making it for their own use?
Yes.
Then why are we messing with it?
Safety.
Well,
what people do in their own homes is their own business.
Well,
I don't want to be cynical here, but I mean, so if you have an explosion, you'd be in violation.
That's right.
I'm not wanting to go in and inspect somebody's home to figure out how they're doing what they're doing. You know, once they're making something for sale, they're commercial. That's a whole different critter, but
This is Senator Cruz. This has been a big problem in Colorado with people not just blowing up their own house, but their neighbor's house.
Right. But they're using solvents.
Correct.
And so we heard Mrs. Hutchinson, if I remember correctly, talking about how they would do their extractions, and basically she would not be able to do that because they use a low heat. Mm-hmm. To actually accomplish that. That's what I'm attempting
right.
to
so
call
you're,
out.
You're trying to narrow it down so
again,
that people
you won't
can
know
still
that until, as Representative Olson, you don't know that until the explosion happens.
Well, you're not going to know it either way. And yeah. since if someone wants to go in and use solvents, even though it's against the law, they're still going to do it. And then, the, you know, how are you going to know that?
You're going to get the bang. You're right.
Yeah.
Unenforceable.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, Senator Pruzanski, you know, we're going to have to figure this out for the law enforcement authority so they can deal with it then. How's that sound?
There we go.
Okay. Let's,
so what does that mean? We don't need a definition?
Listen, we've got 10 more minutes, so let's move through this as quickly as we can.
Within Section 2, page 8, lines 7 through 11, the establishment of fees, there needs to be provided a greater clarity about what additional fees OLCC would like to levy and why.
That's self-explanatory. Next one.
Section 3, page 9, lines 2 through 6, the OLCC purchase, possession, and seizure of marijuana. The proposed action is to clarify the ability for OLCC to purchase, possess, or seize marijuana makes as sense. Limited to enforcement or sting operations. The fourth one, page 9, lines 27, sellers versus retailers. In that line, replace the word sellers with retailers to better track with the proposed license classifications. Section 5, pages 9 through 10, lines 29 through 2, the point of measurement of schools. Clarify that the point of measurement for schools, that 1,000 feet, only applies to contiguous school property where classes are held and occupied by school buildings. Next item, Section 6, page 10, lines 18 through 26, the adding of the research license. This might be a section where the research license might be added, requiring OLCC to not unreasonably delay or the approval or denying of licenses. The next one, Section 6, page 11, lines 2 through 7, physical enclosures and licenses. Clarify that this section exempts growers and potentially processors, too. Starting on the second page, Section 7, page 11, lines 8 through 16, growing marijuana near schools. Clarify that this section does not apply to home grows, so allowing someone to grow marijuana within 1,000 feet from a school so long as they are a home grow and not a licensed operation. Section 8, page 11, lines 17 through 25, again, very similar, transfer or delivery of marijuana near schools. Clarify that this section does not apply to people gifting marijuana to others in their own homes. Section 9, page 12, lines 5 through 8, checking the age prior to the sale of marijuana. We discussed this a little earlier this evening. Clarify that this section only applies to retailers, however. Section 13, pages 13 and 14, lines 28 through 16, bonds. Change the requirement of bonds to only apply to retailers, as it looks like the committee may be moving to a point-of-sale tax. Section 14, pages 14, lines 22 through 24, the size of insurance required. Reduce the size of liability insurance required either to reflect the size of the business or just reduce it entirely. Yeah. Sections 24, pages 20 and 21, lines 24 through 20, the point of taxation. This might be a place where we can change the point of taxation to the point of retail sale. Mm-hmm. Section 25, pages 21 and 22, seizure of property. This section makes it clear that OLCC can seize marijuana to cover a business tax lien. However, if the committee does change the point of taxation to the point of sale, that would mean that the committee the commission could seize marijuana from retail stores. Under the system potentially devising, that marijuana would be seized would already be tested for potency and purity. This section also stipulates that marijuana seized can only be sold to another license holder. It raises the question whether or not if the marijuana is already tested for potency and purity, whether or not that marijuana should not be destroyed.
Okay, that's definitely a policy issue that probably ought to.
No, I mean it's called out in the measure that they are the 844, and yeah, I agree. There's policy throughout there.
Section 26, page 22, the length of records must be kept. This section allows OLCC the ability to look at a licensee's records and change the time from 2 years to 7 years. Part of this is a harmonization effort. On page 49, line 13, that same change must also be noted. Section 29, pages 30 and 31, the maximum civil penalty. Instead of leaving it simply a maximum civil penalty of $5,000 per day at the max, this section would be better served by replacing it with a schedule describing the infraction, the length of the infraction, and the expected costs associated with it. Section 30, page 31, the marijuana enforcement fund. There is no mention of what the OLCC can and can't spend the funds in the marijuana enforcement funds on. The dash ones might be better served by clarifying that language to ensure that those monies can only be used for enforcement and not OLCC general administration.
Well, that may be a bit broad. There's the administration of the program.
Senator Beyer, do you have a question?
I'm sorry. I was just saying that latter restriction may be a bit broad. There's some general administration that the department would have, and you'd want to make sure that we didn't do that.
Well, I agree with that as it pertains to the enforcement fund for enforcement action and the administrative costs that's associated with it. But at the same time, you don't want to – I personally would not want to see this actually being used to actually run OLCC and other
– I agree with that. I was thinking that rather than just enforcement, you're talking about the administration and administration and enforcement of the program.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Can only be used for the administration and enforcement.
Excellent.
Last one on page two, section 36, page 35, marijuana found at pharmacies, that the proposed action is there should be included some reasonable steps need to be taken to get that marijuana back to its owner or to have go back into the inventory of a dispensary or retail operation prior to destroying it.
This May would I ask be, you a question? What does that mean?
Huh? This basically would mean, based on the way I read the 844, they're basically saying if someone left their product at the store and walked out, they would have a duty to destroy it. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically if you walked in at a pharmacy and you left your medicine on the counter, they're not going to take it and destroy it. They're going to either call you up and say, hey, you forgot something, or they're going to potentially be able to take it back because if it's not tampered, it's going to, you know, Senator Farioli's talked about using the marijuana that's captured through a forfeiture. I mean, it doesn't make sense to go burn it up if it's actually hasn't been tainted.
Yeah, it is what happened.
Okay.
Yeah, what confused us was marijuana found at pharmacies.
It was a lingo there.
Well, I think this is the one that came from the.
Anything once it's dispensed at the pharmacy, they do destroy.
Well, first they're not going to call the patient up and say you left it on the counter.
Okay, can you share with the?
The issue was that they said at the pharmacy they would be destroying it. I said, but that doesn't make a lot of sense. If you know that someone has just walked out the store without taking their purchase, wouldn't you take some steps to try to get it to them instead of just destroying it and saying sorry? I mean, what if they walk back in and they got out of the car and they walk back in and they.
I think this is, as I recall, I think this came from the Walmarts and big pharmacies of the world that were just looking for some protection that they wouldn't be cracked down on by the federal government if they ended up with marijuana in their presence that somebody had left. I think that was the intent of this. If it didn't get there, I think.
So they're looking to be the retailers?
I couldn't figure out how we're getting marijuana at pharmacies. That confused me. Just
Madam Co-Chair.
Well, I could.
Wow.
I've got to run, but I just wanted to. Before
excuse us, please.
Before I left, I just wanted to ask about the record keeping, the 7 years, up from 2 years. The 7 years really seems intense to me. So I hope we can discuss that unless it relates to the IRS or something.
That's what they were saying.
Really?
I just saw that in one place it had, was saying two needed to go to seven, and then on page 49 it still had two. This was just saying that it was not. Consistent.
And I believe they were trying to make it consistent with tax record keeping requirements.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I
Okay. Let's race through this. Right. We're going to lose committee members, including me.
The final page, section 47, page 40, sailor service. This language is taken from statutes governing bars.
Thanks.
Potentially change the word service to providing to more accurately reflect that this is more like a liquor store issue. Section 49, page 40, the inspection of records. I believe on our meeting on the 23rd, Senator Przanski and Representative Helm were requested to add some language regarding the inspection of records. That's where this might be placed. There could be language added is the language allowing emergency access to those records by OLCC so long as there's a reasonable suspicion or probable cause.
It should be immediate.
So the question would become, at what point would the business have the responsibility of turning over its books? The next one, the transfer of license, section 51, page 41, fully clarify that the license is not transferable to another person or entity, and it can't be sold or traded for financial consideration. Next one, section 51, page 42, in the event of a default, add language to ensure that another secured party may only continue operations for a short period of time, and or that entity must meet all requirements for licensing, including that of residency. Section 51, page 42, in the event of a default, there needs to be some additional thought potentially put around the idea of licensure and land sales between parties, specifically if one person completes a land sale contract to another person who then establishes a licensed marijuana facility on that land. If that second person defaults from the first person, takes back possession of the land, as in that person would immediately be breaking the law for having an unlicensed marijuana operation.
I can't think of everything.
Well, that actually came in from another attorney.
Section 61, page 49, the length of records that must be kept. We've discussed that previously. Section 69, page 54.
Let him finish.
Why would we want to get in the way of the sale of a business asset? Understanding that they may have to meet qualifications.
Yeah, they'd have to jump through the
hoops. Why would we want to get in the way of that?
If I've got a store and I'm old and I want to sell it and get out, I should be able to sell it to somebody, same as any other legitimate business.
No, the issue is that right now banks are not loaning money to on property. So
right.
Some people are actually going through land sale contracts to do this. If for some reason there's a default or whatever, for whatever reason, the seller has to take possession of that property, and there's marijuana, let's say, being grown on that property, all of a sudden now they're going to be on the wrong side of the law. So we need just to make certain there's some type of clarity that they're not going to be in violation of the law if something like that occurs. My understanding, that's how people are conducting transactions of sales of property, because there's not money being loaned.
I'd suggest we move this to the policy issue on 91, because we're going to have to set some parameters on what they're supposed to do with all that marijuana.
Okay. The final one, section 69, page 54, lines 7 through 9. This language looks to be modeled after regulations regarding bars and might be better served by having language reflecting the reality that marijuana retail facilities function more like liquor stores.
Okay, next steps. I think what I'd like to do, Senator Przanski, is you and I can get together and do a preliminary cut on policy versus technical, and then maybe we can work with Shannon to kind of meld your suggestions, especially on some of the definitions, together. And hopefully we'll have more clarity at the next meeting. The next meeting of the Marijuana Committee is Chang.
Question.
You have a question?
I do. This is for Adam.
Okay.
Adam, is there what are the entities in Colorado and Washington State that would function as the administrative authority overarching the recreational marijuana programs?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Farioli, I don't have that information at this time, but I can.
What agencies?
Yeah. So I guess the subset of that question is, has anybody established a cannabis commission, a standalone cannabis commission?
That's good and that's bad.
Yeah, I know.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Farioli, I will certainly look into whether or not a new entity, a cannabis commission, has been created in either Washington or Colorado.
And, Madam Chair, the source of those questions is, notwithstanding the heroic efforts of the OLCC staff, my confidence in their ability to manage this program is rapidly diminishing. So, you know, some of the complexities that we've discussed lead me to believe that there's a lot of expertise that currently doesn't exist in the commission, and it doesn't currently exist in the staff. So, you know, I'm curious about comments that our House colleagues have made about the level of expertise that is in the community that perhaps we're underutilizing. But I guess, you know, I guess as an illustration, I would use this question. We're talking about creating a brand new license for research facilities, yet the agency doesn't seem to know the difference between micrograms and milligrams. And I would be curious to know how, you know, this highly technical medical specialty will be administered by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which perhaps it should be under the OHA, not the OLCC, just the question of medical marijuana research facilities. So I just, you know, I'll add the note of skepticality, which is growing, and I'll make the suggestion that the OLCC is the wrong facility to have administer or license research facilities.
Okay, well, on that cheery note, I will announce that we will not be having a meeting on Monday, and we will be reconvening on Wednesday, so check OLIS for the agenda. And we are adjourned.
Here, and I just been a nice cheer.
And we are adjourned.